Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day in 1717. We would discover what Blackbeard would look like. He would capture a fellow pirate's ship and hold the captain of that ship hostage for 8 hours. Upon a release of that captain, that captain would be the one to describe what Blackbeard would look like. That is, of course, Henry Bostock, who was the captain of the merchant sloop, the Margaret. Interestingly, that was way back in 1717. In 1932, on this day, Einstein would be granted a US visa. For those who don't know, Albert Einstein is German. In 1955, on this day, the Montgomery Improvement Association would be formed by, amongst others, Martin Luther King, following the developments, of course, of December 1st, where Rosa Parks would refuse to stand up on a bus, and she would then begin the protests that would begin on this day, December 5th, a couple of days later. 1971, on this day, Libya would nationalize Beyond Petroleum's concession. That must have been a very tough time in history on that day. And on this day in 2006, a naval officer would overthrow the government of Fiji and subsequently become the Prime Minister of Fiji. That is, of course, the naval officer Commodore Frank Bainimarama, who would do that on this day in 2006. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at some developments from SAA. The SAA strike that found passengers without flights today. We're going to take a look at that. We're going to speak to the National Transport Movement around what it is they are looking to achieve with the strike. They're one of the unions involved there. We did reach out to the SAA for comment. We got a press release from them, but no confirmation that they would be willing to have a conversation. Then we've also got a conversation with Money Badgers, Karel van Wyk, around Bitcoin hitting $100,000 a coin today. We're going to reflect on that and see what it means for the crypto landscape. And then we've got a conversation with Standard Bank around the insurance side of things ahead of the festive season, what you need to do to prepare yourself if you want to ensure that your precious goods and loved things or treasured items are secure going into the festive period. And then we wrap the show up with an SME of the week. We're going to take a look at a company called Breeze Delivery.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at the market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Nick. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Interesting day on the market side of things. Markets kind of moving steadily along, but I suppose the major news coming through from China. China deciding that they would impose a ban on certain minerals and metals to the US, and I can't help but wonder, are we back? Is the trade war back on? Are we in for an exciting 2025?
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to the listeners. Yeah, that was that greeted us as we came in this morning, that mineral ban. I can't even pronounce them. There were three essential minerals that were used basically in modern sort of transition to EV. In fact, it was something sound like geranium. I think it was called geranium. But one of these metals used heavily in lithium and batteries, EV batteries. China have the luxury of having majority of these rare earth minerals. And I think it was actually a sort of a rhetoric to the Americans who started off with a ban on chips the day before. So yes, it's a bit of a, are we back here again, Jimmy? I think we probably are.
Yeah, when I was looking at some of the metals, I mean, antimony is the other one, gallium is the other one, and it sounds very much like metals that the US use in technological things. So everything from chips and things that go into the processors. So the likes of NVIDIA would put this in their processors. And I believe China's a 50% supplier of the US. I'll check those figures. But more importantly, it looks as though these metals are also used in military operations or military things that are built by the United States. So this is a very clear stance by Beijing that they will not be bullied by Trump, following Trump's rhetoric around the BRICS currency or the BRICS nations. This is a very clear response, and China's known for that. China's known for not wasting time in dealing with these sorts of conversations. They respond swiftly, and they respond very confidently.
Yeah, they have done. And I must add as well, as we said, you know, that these particular rare earths and a lot of these rare earth minerals that are used, you've already pointed out, defense, they're used extensively in the batteries that are found in most lithium batteries these days and what they are found in electronic devices. And China has the luxury of having the majority of these under their ground. America doesn't. So almost like, be careful what you wish for. You want a trade war, as you say, Xi Jinping says, well, we can have one, and let's see who comes out of this. But the bottom line is, you know, all of us sitting on the outside of it, the world doesn't need another trade war. It's, you know, it's going to be a volatile 4 years of this. We haven't even started. Only coming, Mr. Trump only comes on the 20th of January. We've already started. It's going to be very tiring 4 years, I think.
Yeah, as you say that, I mean, you say the rest of us, being all the other countries kind of literally caught in the middle physically and economically, that's not where we want to be. That's not where anyone wants to be. I mean, we saw the trade war in 2020, albeit that was in the middle of a pandemic. It might have been a bit more subdued than what it could have been. At this point, where we're looking for China to be the spark or the stimulating factor from a demand perspective, now's not the time for a trade war.
No, it's not. And I think if you take a step back, you know, certainly, I mean, let's talk from our point of view here in South Africa. So, you know, China is now South Africa's biggest trading partner, and it's overtaken Europe a few years ago. So what happens in China, you know, definitely affects all of us here in South Africa from an economic point of view. So we really need China to carry on growing and to carry on turning and carry on using our goods. So a trade war doesn't help anyone. And I must say as well, just from a with all the sort of the geopolitics happening and what's happening with the wars in the Middle East, Ukraine and Russia, which is nowhere near to being resolved, you know, the world almost needs some sort of cool heads, and America's always acted as, you know, I guess some sort of global policeman. And when you do need, you know, that sort of stern and I guess sort of clear heads coming in, this is not the right way to do it. And South Africa, you know, we really want all this to go nicely, and right now it doesn't look that good.
I think part of that problem is the fact that the incoming president of the United States seldom uses logic and reason at times when putting out such statements. But we'll keep an eye on that. We'll see how that unfolds. Let's stick with the U.S. for a second, Nick. Jobless claims came in today. We know we've got non-farms numbers coming out tomorrow. What is the expectation? We got ADP numbers yesterday. What's the expectation around the U.S. jobs picture? And what does that mean for that one outstanding rate decision that is to come in the month of December?
Yeah, so traders, traditionally tomorrow is the big one. It's what the Americans typically call Jobs Friday. So today, as you said, Jimmy, we had the weekly numbers. It's usually quite a good indicator. So unemployment benefits rose 9,000, coming in at 224,000. That is, I guess, almost consistent with steady job growth. So good news for the American economy, but maybe not such good news for those who are thinking they're going to be rate cuts coming and more rate cuts along the line, because tomorrow we've got the big one, as I said, it's non-farm payrolls, and we're looking for a number to increase by sort of 200,000 jobs. And the one we all sort of take note of as well is the unemployment rate, and we're looking at to come in a little softer. So the market is looking for 4.2% tomorrow afternoon, and that's up from 4.1% we saw in October. So what does this mean for interest rates and markets and the Federal Reserve? Well, they meet in December. We don't. The SARB and a few other banks don't meet in December, but the Americans do. The Federal Reserve meets in December. Market is pricing a 0.25% interest rate cut. But I guess the question is, you know, how more are coming? Because if numbers keep continuing to come in like they are, like these sort of sets of numbers, you know, 4.2% unemployment rate is not bad. In fact, most people would argue that's almost full employment. So I battle to see if there's more interest rate sort of cuts coming. And I guess that's what we've got to battle with next year. And I think they're almost taking a wait and see stance because the dollar's kind of been treading water a little bit the last few days.
Nick, when we look at our own local picture, what are we seeing shape up there? I'm seeing a bit of inconsistency from the likes of resource counters that have been under pressure for quite some time. Financial stocks this week also having a bit of an up and down week. One day up, one day down, today up. How are you seeing the local landscape sort of ending off the tail end of the year? I mean, obviously, it could be that investors are taking some profits and just getting out of things ahead of the December break. But how are you seeing things?
So if you look at just, I mean, the headline numbers, Jimmy. So, I mean, the all share up almost 13% year to date. I mean, if you had told me that in January, I wouldn't have believed you. So, I mean, that's really good going. This month also off to not a bad start. I think about 2.5% up already. So maybe we do get that Santa Claus rally. But that's the broader picture. If you drill down to the numbers, it tells a slightly different story. So to your point, some of the miners, the resources, have had a tough few months with the stronger dollar, you know, ever since the incoming president, Mr. Trump, has put the sort of the charge on the dollar. You know, obviously, expectedly, the commodities and the miners have had a tough time. But the rest of the market's actually been doing reasonably well. You know, we had the Boxer listing, which was a huge success. Retailers have been pretty strong. Our financials are behaving quite nicely, and that's with the Rand trying to break back under 18 as we speak. So almost like two different markets. And I guess for us and for our clients, what we're looking for is, I guess, a little bit more consistency. I think you mentioned it. You know, we've had sort of very lumpy numbers. GDP print wasn't great because the agriculture number was bad. I'm sure you talked about it on your show. The rest of it looked okay. But we just need some more consistency going into next year. We need what the economists are calling 2 and 20, Jimmy. It's 2% GDP and 2% inflation is the magic number what we want to get to ultimately. So let's hope we get more of those next year. But right now it's a little bit of wait and see, and the market start to thin out sort of the next week or two going into Christmas season as well.
We need consistency next year, but the markets are going to take a bit of a break and we will leave the conversation there because we have run out of time, but we'll certainly catch up and look ahead to what 2025 could look like. Nick, thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Nick Kunz, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, joining me to take a look at some of the market developments around the world as well as how the local markets have been faring.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next edition of Fix SA. I'm in conversation with Lawrence Rapp, who is a respected thought leader with over a decade of experience in the property sector. He leads the Vukile Property Fund. We're going to take a look at the biggest barriers to South Africa achieving its full economic potential and also his views on specific leadership qualities that South Africa needs in both the public and private sectors to drive meaningful change.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
My name is Sipho Mwanza, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Mezza Wines, which offers tokenized wine investments, which are not correlated to traditional financial markets and is becoming a popular alternative investment. Be sure to join me and Kieran Ryan on the MoneyWeb Crypto podcast this week, where I will explain how tokenized wine investment works.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Today was that day, folks. Today was the day everybody had been waiting for, especially if you're a crypto investor. Bitcoin hit $100,000 per Bitcoin. We're going to take a look at this and see what it means for the crypto landscape. Those that believe that the cryptocurrency is going to die clearly have another conversation to be had. I'm joined on the line by the founder at Money Badger, Karel van Wyk, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Karel. Lovely to speak to you. Significant day, milestone day, big day for Bitcoin, but also for the whole cryptocurrency landscape. Did you get a sense of just how big it was, at least in South Africa?
Yeah, for sure. Anytime there's a spike in the price, we see an increase in trading volume. And for sure, this was quite a significant price to exceed $100,000. So in South Africa today, we've seen at least on one exchange, we've seen over R500 million traded. And then obviously there's multiple in South Africa. If we look globally, it's more in the order of $100 billion that have been traded in the past 24 hours. And we'll probably see that number go up over the next couple of hours.
That's a huge number. Carl, what does that mean for the crypto landscape? I mean, obviously with Bitcoin being the leader in the space, one of the first coins, if not the first cryptocurrency to be rolled out, other coins would also benefit from this kind of positivity and this kind of movement we've seen in the past, that Bitcoin kind of leads the sector and then the other coins follow. Are we seeing interest in other cryptocurrencies at the moment? Are we expecting that we'll see a general pickup? I mean, December is always also a really good month for cryptocurrencies, or at least historically it has been.
Yeah, I suppose there's a strong correlation between price movement of Bitcoin and other crypto tokens. But if we look over a long enough time frame, then what we tend to see is that there's only one king in town, and that is Bitcoin. And everything else seems to diminish in value relative to Bitcoin. So whether the price of those tokens in dollar terms go up or down, it's largely irrelevant. Over a long period of time, they all go down versus Bitcoin.
Carl, when we look at the Bitcoin landscape, the price has definitely moved quite a bit since the introduction of things like institutional investors. I remember when the first Bitcoin ETFs were approved by the SEC, there was a lot of hype and positivity around that. When we look at the future of Bitcoin from where we are now, and future of cryptocurrencies in general, it's undeniable now at this point that cryptos are here to stay, with Bitcoin obviously, as you said, being the leader of that pack. Are we kind of seeing that potentially going into next year and years beyond that, that this is a legitimate asset class where investors might want to, say, diversify out of the traditional asset classes that we've known? And are we starting to see that kind of interest pick up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a multifaceted question. On the one hand, we're asking about whether it's a legitimate asset class. Now, I suppose that's up to everybody's interpretation and opinion. But I think maybe if you take a strategic view, it's not a terrible idea to consider at least some small proportion of your net worth to be held in Bitcoin. Of course, the expectation is if you even allocate a small proportion over a long period of time, it will probably become the major portion. And then in terms of sort of global events that have an impact on the price of Bitcoin, we might start, in fact, we already starting to see maybe it's a case of the tail wagging the dog, or the dog wagging the tail, where we'll start to see major political events that occur due to the movement in price of Bitcoin. So we've already seen countries adopt Bitcoin as legal tender in the past 3 years. As you said, we've seen major ETFs launch, and I think going forward we'll see even more major events that's related to the price of Bitcoin as it goes up.
You did bring up that important point around more adoption and countries starting to adopt. If I remember correctly, El Salvador is one of the countries that now uses Bitcoin as official legal tender. So that definitely means that there is a market for it, no matter how it is that you are looking at it. Carl, looking at the rest of the crypto space and looking at just cryptocurrencies in general, we've obviously touched on the use cases broadening and getting more and more attractive for everyone. There have also been conversations that have been developing around how we now integrate things like blockchain technology into other areas. As a blockchain fan, as a Bitcoin fan, are you seeing that we could potentially be using this kind of momentum that we're seeing on Bitcoin now to potentially go into more things around the crypto space, around the blockchain space?
I tend to be generally skeptical of people that's punting blockchain as a solution to everything. In general, you could probably use a simple database to achieve the same thing. There's very few use cases that legitimately requires the use of a blockchain. A blockchain tends to be something that's expensive, slow, and technically challenging to manage. So if you do find one of those use cases, it's typically related to something where you need high degrees of trust. And when it comes to something like Bitcoin, obviously the use case is that of money. And so we need a high degree of trust where we do need something like a blockchain. But for most other use cases I've seen, look, I've been in the industry for many years, for 10 plus years, and I can tell you that most people are punting blockchain as snake oil. There's very few legitimate use cases, actually. So you have to take a let's say, a 10-year view and see what projects have survived over a period of 5+ years.
Carl, what does this mean for the future of cryptos going into 2025? Are you bullish that the momentum we're currently seeing on Bitcoin will continue? Do we have $150,000 in mind as a target? Have you looked at any numbers? I mean, obviously, this is all-time highs, so it's very difficult to predict how much higher we're going to go from here.
Look, fundamentally, you have to decide whether you think that Bitcoin is something that is scarce or not. If you do take the view that Bitcoin is scarce, whether that's digital scarcity versus something like physical scarcity, but let's assume that Bitcoin is an asset that is scarce, then as long as there are more dollars being printed in this world, the price of Bitcoin will continue to go up in dollar terms.
We know the US is not short on printing dollars. They do it quite often. We'll leave the conversation there, Carl. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Carl van Wyk, who is the founder at Money Badger, joining us to take a look at the significant milestone that Bitcoin crossed today and the crypto landscape in general.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. The festive season is upon us, and many individuals might be looking to go away and looking to travel a bit. And ahead of that, we thought we'd take a look at what you need to put in place to protect your valuables, especially if you are looking to be away from them. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Hadi Ncube, who is the head of personal products at Standard Insurance Limited, which is a part of Standard Bank Group, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Dr. Ncube. Thanks so much for taking the time. With the festive season upon us, what kind of risks typically come up from an insurance perspective that consumers might want to be thinking about at this time?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners, and thank you for having me on the line. This is the festive time, and people generally will be going away. Generally, what tends to be the problem during the festive season is that we see some weather-related risk. This is where, in your absence, you know, the severe storms that usually come during this period of time in different parts of the country. And also what we have observed from our side is that during this period, you know, if we look at the amount of vehicles on the road, the accidents that happen, and also damages to the vehicles, and also even in some instances, injuries to human life. Because of the fact that security could be compromised by the absence of the families on holiday, we also see an increase in theft of household items. And also it tends to show also from our side where we see pipes and geyser-related damage because of the absence of people in their homes. What tends to happen is that they may fail or forget to switch off their geysers, and there could be maintenance-related item issues with the geyser, and it starts leaking. And in some instances, you know, due to changes in water pressure as a result of the switching on and off of water, either by municipal authorities, this is also can contribute to geysers burst. And the families can be surprised coming back on to find that they've had some leaks in their homes. Thanks, Jimmy.
Dr. Ncube, when you talk about the leaks in the homes, the first thing that jumps to mind is water damage. Because I imagine if we're away and a geyser does happen to burst, then whatever's in and around that vicinity, or whatever the water runs into, that water's not going to be swept up or cleaned up immediately. Is water damage something that people can kind of claim for alongside something like a geyser burst, or even if the water damage is caused by the weather conditions? Where do we kind of land on what constitutes a water damage claim?
Yeah, generally in terms of water damage, we're looking at damage that is as a result of weather-related issues, be it hail, storm, flooding. Those would traditionally be covered by insurance companies. But you also have water damage as a result of pipes can burst, and also geysers can leak. those would typically be covered by insurers. I'm talking about damage to the pipes themselves and the damage to the geyser in terms of replacement of pipes and replacement of geysers. But you also look at the consequential damage. This could be damage to the built-in cables, damage to laminated flooring, and damage to even household property and contents in that regard. However, what we would generally exclude is in the instance of families going out on holiday and say before they left, there was either a water cut and they opened taps and they forgot to close them. In this instance, such wouldn't be covered because it's not considered generally fortuitous and accidental to a large degree, but also it has got a moral hazard component in it, and that's primarily insurers. The reason why insurers wouldn't want to be keen to insure such damage.
When you're looking at those hazards, or you're looking at those kind of negligent decisions, I mean, sometimes it's a genuine accident, sometimes individuals leave them there by not paying attention. From an insurance perspective, if I have these policies in place, as the policy holder, what are the obligations that I have to keep in mind? What are the things that I have to keep in mind so that my policy does cover me in the event of me needing to claim?
I think overall, you know, from an insurer, as an insured person or policy holder, one of the primary obligations of the policy holder is to ensure that you pay your premium upfront, as is required by your contract. So that is one aspect, that you make sure that you are always fully paid and you don't run the risk of not being covered because of either the non-payment of premium. If the next aspect is that when we do insure as insurers, what is quite fundamentally important is that the provision of correct information upfront for the assessment of your risk and the determination of the correct premium that you should be paying is quite a pertinent consideration when it comes to damages. So because you are the sole custodian of the information that understand yourselves and your property and what needs to be insured correctly, it is important that policyholders provide the correct information to ensure that in future there's no disagreement about what should have been and what could have been. So added to that is that if you look also in terms of by correct information, also it speaks to the values. Policyholders, to a certain degree, they understand the property and they can get an evaluation of what their property, I'm talking the buildings, I'm talking the household contents, they can get a sense of what the correct value that they need to insure for in that regard. To some extent, insurers have got the capacity to help where needed, but it is primarily an obligation of insurance to make of the policyholder to ensure that the correct information is provided, including correct values that for which the property needs to be insured for.
Dr. Ngube, as an insurer, what kind of tips and easy wins do you have that consumers can make use of? You mentioned the fact that we've got weather conditions or storms that typically happen around this time of year in certain parts of the country. What easy things can people do to protect their homes, protect themselves, their valued items, and just reduce the amount of claims? I imagine nobody wants to really claim from insurance every single time. It becomes quite a process. But what can people do just from their own perspective?
There are quite a number of things. So if I take overall holistically, let's start with household property. If you know that you're not going to be around for a particular time period over the festive period, for example, you have got to make sure that when you leave that your linked alarm is set up and is in working condition, because that could also help as a deterrent in terms of intruders coming through. And in some instances, if you are in a neighborhood position, you, depending on the extent of how you interact with your neighbors, you could also have them watch out in the instance where an alarm is triggered, that they can phone you or help trigger the response, the armed response, to help in that regard. So that's the security part of it. If you look at just the fact that the incidence of vehicle accident during the festive period, one is to make sure that you drive at reasonable speeds or within acceptable speeds in a safe driving way. That's the other way that could avoid one getting involved in accident. For example, avoiding drunken driving, which we see that it contributes to quite a number of claims that come through it, a number of accidents generally. So if we then also consider from a building perspective, you know, maintenance of the building is quite useful in the sense that if you maintain your building, especially you look at the roofing structure of the building, making sure that you repair potential cracks on the roof that could actually result in water seeping or coming through and ingressing into the roof. These are some of the tips that policyholders can make sure that over a period of time, they can continue maintaining their home in a way to avoid what potentially could be a claim in future that may be rejected purely because of maintenance-related issues.
Dr. Ngube, is it worthwhile informing your insurer if you intend to be away from home for an extended period of time? I mean, obviously, in the festive time, when people are traveling or going on holidays, homes that are kind of vacant for a couple of days start to look and become prime targets for criminal activities. Is it worthwhile to have a conversation with your insurer to say, hey, guys, I'm not going to be around. Please, can you guys keep an eye out? Or is that a conversation to be had with, as you said, with your neighbors and a trusted family friend to say, just check in on the house? Is there anything the insurer can do from that perspective?
So there are instances where the insurer is required to be informed, especially in traveling. For example, some insurers need to be informed about your travel if you're actually going across the outside of the country and you're driving an insured vehicle. Some insurers requires to be informed so that in future, if anything happens, if you're across the border and in the event of that damage, when it comes to a claim perspective, you're already informed and they're very much aware of that. So in the generality of, let's say, from a home perspective, yes, you can have your insurer engagement, but they would just give you more tips around what you need to do, considering the fact that you'll be away for a period of time. They'll also let you in some of the insurers within the policies. They have occupancy conditions that speaks to the fact that you may not leave your property vacant for a certain minimum number of days without anybody. So they would keep on reminding you of that, for example, if you have to go away for more than 60 days, if there's a condition that says beyond 60 days, the property is vacant, may not be insured. If you made contact with the insurer, your insurer can reach an agreement with you. That's one point. Or the insurer can emphasize that part to you to say, don't forget that beyond 60 or 90 days, you may not have insurance, therefore make the appropriate arrangement to have somebody in the property beyond that particular point to preserve your insurance going forward.
Make sure you are prepared this holiday and festive period, especially if you will not be at home. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, Dr. Ngube. That's Dr. Hardy Ngube, who is the head of personal products at the Standard Insurance Limited business, which is a part of the Standard Bank Group, joining us to take a look at how to be better prepared for your insurance claims this festive period. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise. And you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
coming up to 6:40. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and we are taking a look at the latest developments from SAA. The pilots at SAA, belonging to two of the unions that represent most of the pilots, have gone on a strike. This is a measure that they wanted to avoid, but it looks as though we've finally gotten to this point. I'm joined on the line by the General Secretary for the National Transport Movement, Ephraim Mphahlele, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Dr. Mphahlele, thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding what's going on here in particular with the flights. I mean, I can imagine consumers and passengers arriving at an airport and being told that your flight is no longer going to be taking off is a very big surprise. When did the strike start and what was the main reason here?
And good evening, sir, and your viewers. The strike started earlier this morning. And it was basically for the purpose of pursuing the strike demands or the wage negotiation demands relating to a 15.7% increase. And in the main, that particular demand was informed by the fact that the salaries of the pilots were actually cut by half during COVID-19, and they had still not been restored to that particular level. And we believe that the 15.7% can actually go a long way in moving towards the restoration of the salaries to pre-COVID levels. But then with regard to the impact of the strike on the operation of SAA, it had a huge impact, and SAA had, as a result of that, cancelled a lot of flights. But we are of the view that SAA management does not have a corporate will to resolve the strike action. We met up with them yesterday, and the acting CEO walked out of the wage negotiation meeting. That's the kind of disrespect that management had been displaying throughout the wage negotiations. But we still believe that they should return back to the negotiation table so that we can then engage and explore various permutations as to how we can then best resolve this strike action.
Dr. Mphahlele, the SAA has put out a statement from their perspective saying that they obviously are reduced flights from their perspective. They say the situation is regrettable, but that the business as SAA will continue. Have they engaged with you since putting out the statement?
They had indicated that they would call us for the purpose of resuming the wage negotiations. We're still waiting for them to actually do that.
Okay.
We are ready to engage with them and, of course, explore various options in respect of the resolution of this matter.
In terms of those resolutions and exploring that, I mean, understanding, of course, 15% could be seen as a significant increase for a single year. But obviously, as you said, the pilots and the other staff did take a significant pay cut during the pandemic. Are you open to negotiating a slightly different structure or a structure that results in a 15% to maybe even 20% over a number of years? How flexible is the situation from your side, understanding that, of course, this is probably the busiest time, and as the pilots that you represent have already expressed, they do want to be in the skies and servicing passengers. How flexible is the negotiation from your perspective?
No, let me just say that cautiously, we may be more than willing to hear them out in respect of how we can best resolve this particular issue. It is also in our best interest to see the airline reclaiming its glory, its past glory, so to speak. But in the light of what management had been doing, we do not believe that they are intending to ensure the sustainability of the airline going forward.
Ndadla Bahlela, between yourselves and the SAA Pilots Association, you represent a significant proportion of the SAA pilots. I think it's probably about 80 to 90% of the pilots that are there at the moment. What happens in the event that this isn't resolved? I mean, obviously SAA, from their perspective, have just returned to profitability, and things like them having to charter alternative flights would become a costly thing from their side of things. What do we do here? How long are you prepared to continue with this action until you are heard?
We are intending to proceed with the strike action until such a time that SAA would have acceded to our demands. We believe that they can afford the demands that we have tabled, given the fact that they had generated profit in the last two financial years.
Ndata Mahlela, have you quantified how much of the how much money that increase will cost SAA? Have you got the numbers around if the 15% is implemented of the pilots that you represent, or of the staff that you represent? It might be more than just the pilots. Have you quantified just around a rough figure around how much this will cost SAA?
We have, but the information is confidential, and we do not want to share that information publicly. But we have quantified the amount, and that is the reason why we are saying the amount in question is affordable in the circumstances.
Would this...
We have done our calculations, and we came to a conclusion that they can afford what we have asked for.
Would this be a once-off increase that you're looking to discuss here, or would this be something that you would then look to have implemented next year as well? So if the 15% is agreed to now and we go into or the strike is resolved and the pilots return to work, is this something that you might be saying we expect another 15% next year?
No. We may, of course, depending on the circumstance, the prevailing circumstances in the new year, decide on a new percentile increment. Which may not necessarily be 15%.
Well, of course, economic conditions are going to be subject to change. There's nothing you can do around predicting those, and life is one of those things where you have to make the decisions with the information in front of you. We really hope this does get resolved, because we definitely want to see SAA return to the glory that it was as the largest airline on the continent. I think we'll leave the conversation there for now. We'll see if we can try and engage the SAA team once again. We have gotten just that press statement that they put out, but for now we'll leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, Ephraim. That's Ephraim Mphahlela, who is the General Secretary at the National Transport Movement, on the latest SAA pilots strike that has seen some flights being grounded and some passengers being left without any solutions.
The Property Pod.
We're back looking at the residential property market on the Property Pod this week. We zone into residential property as an investment. According to recent research by Lightstone, residential property may be losing its investment appeal. Hayley Ivins-Downs, Managing Executive for Real Estate at Lightstone, is on the latest episode to share more insights.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's once again time to wrap up our week with an SME of the week. We take a look at a small business doing really well and hopefully help them do a little bit better if we can in any way. I'm joined on the line by the co-founder of a company called Breeze Delivery, Avi Maja, to take a look at the business and get a sense of what it is that they do. Good evening, Avi. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell me about Breeze. What is it that you guys do?
Thanks, Jimmy. Great to be here with your listeners. Breeze Delivery is a last mile and third-party logistics service provider. What that means is that we are there to help merchants and retailers transition from e-commerce to quick commerce. And how we do this is we think that delivery is becoming a key decision maker for customers to make a purchase online. So we connect to your online store. And if you don't have an online store, we implement and put out a application for you, white labeled app, for us to do your deliveries. And in some instances, we even pick and pack on behalf of merchants where they don't have a presence where we service.
So, Avi, the business itself is not like a Mr. Delivery in the traditional sense, right? You guys offer a slightly different and more tailored solution. Tell me about the differences between you and what a traditional delivery house might look like.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key differentiators in what we do. We don't sell any products. We are services and technology business to empower merchants and online stores that are actually looking to deliver and sell their products more effectively by enhancing that delivery experience.
So you are able to build other companies a delivery app or a delivery service of their own.
Correct. So the key component is that if you want to do delivery, you need to be a delivery expert. And it's very difficult to be like the big players like Uber Eats, Mr. Delivery, because they are dual marketplace. So they sell the food and they also manage the drivers.
Mm.
So typically when businesses go out to market, you already know what products you want to sell. You know how to sell your products, but it's very difficult to become an expert in delivery and last mile logistics. Last mile accounts for 40% of the complexity of the supply chain. So it's a very complex space and you have very limited time to make it work because consumer expectations have changed dramatically in the last few years.
So, Avi, take me through how you guys implement the solution. I mean, if I'm a company that's looking to deploy your solution, what do I need to do? Do I need to build the app? Are you guys building the app? How much is it going to cost me? Take me through the actual structure of how this all works.
So typically, merchants that we work with already have an online presence. And the biggest platforms that we've seen, and it's a global trend all over, is Shopify and WooCommerce. There are other platforms like Magento and so on. So these are platforms that you can easily create a website to sell your products or even convert into an app for your customers to use an app rather than a website. We have applications and plugins that connect to these platforms to pull in orders so that we can let you ship that order once you've picked and packed it internally through your normal sales activities or internal operations. So we essentially, the operating system that enhances that delivery experience and that fulfillment experience for the merchants so that they can have a great customer experience from a booking of a delivery point of view without actually typing in anything. It's simply a matter of clicks, and then our system does the heavy lifting of the logic in terms of understanding the address, where the customer is, when we're going to deliver, if we service that area, how much it's going to cost. And all the merchant needs to do once they've packed the order is click one button to request a shipment, and our driver will come in and deliver. We have two main service types. We have on-demand delivery as well as same-day delivery. On-demand delivery is what you typically see suited to grocery stores, the liquor space, anything that you have multiple locations in the same city where you're actually selling your product or your goods. We do that in 60 minutes, so that's 1 hour deliveries. Order comes in, we bring a driver and they send it out. And then another business unit of ours is same-day delivery. Same-day delivery is typically suited to warehouse or single location type operations where you are selling something online, you have a central warehouse where you're preparing these orders, our drivers will come collect and deliver it to your customer in the same day. So we typically collect in the mornings and then we'll deliver throughout the day in the whole of Johannesburg, Pretoria and Ekurhuleni. So it's effectively the major Gauteng metros as well as Cape Town.
Avi, what about the driving side of it? If I've got these services and I build out my online store and I use your services, do I then need to go and hire my own drivers? How does it all work?
Yeah, that's a really nice thing about Breeze and our value proposition. By integrating to Breeze, you tap into the Breeze driver network. So we've got over 700 drivers on our platform where we've trained, vetted them, all digitally, and we continue to onboard more drivers. So with us, we are essentially your delivery partner because we manage all of that driver-related onboarding and driver-related activities, including a mobile app for our drivers where your customers will be able to track your delivery as if you managing the deliveries yourself as a merchant.
Avi, tell me about some of the other services that you guys have. I see the website has some scooter box advertising and some other services. Tell me about the other things that you guys do to help the businesses that you serve.
Yeah, we see ourselves very much as a technology business, but the business we're in is a delivery business. So everything of ours is technology driven, but we also have to be really practical about the value and the services that we offer. I mean, we have lots of vehicles out on the road doing deliveries. Why not utilize that real estate to actually allow our merchants to advertise on the scooter box, on the scooter boxes that our scooter guys have, or on the vehicles that we have for our same day service? We also do white labeled e-commerce apps for retailers and merchants that are looking to go online and don't actually have an online presence. So we can actually white label an app or a platform that we have. We'll look like your app, or can make some customizations so to get you on that road to start advertising. We also have additional services where we make some bespoke delivery experiences for your customers. So we integrate to WhatsApp so your customers can get real-time tracking and notifications through WhatsApp. We know SMS is used a lot. It's really great. However, you have no understanding of if customers have read your message, how they're engaging with your brand, and they're able to track their orders. So WhatsApp is really nice because we have read receipts. Customers are able to respond, and our amazing support team will give them feedback on the status of their order.
Avi, how much does the service cost? If I'm a merchant looking for either the white label solution, or I've got a solution that I'm just looking for the delivery side of it, how do I kind of get an idea of how much the system or the service will cost me?
Yeah, it will really depend on the service type that you want. However, on a high level, we offer different pricing for on-demand and same-day. On-demand will essentially be just under 50 Rand for a limited range, because obviously these scooter drivers are driving from a store to a delivery location. So we want to make sure that the price is competitive for the end consumer making a purchase. And then for same day deliveries, we charge a flat fee of about 75 Rand throughout the service area that we service. So if you're in Gauteng, say you're in Johannesburg, for example, we will be able to do deliveries for you to Pretoria and pick up on the same day, deliver in Pretoria for a flat 75 Rand.
Sounds like an affordable solution. Avi, how do people get hold of you? What are your contact details? Yeah. Where can people find you? Do you guys have an app in the app stores? Tell us everything.
Yeah, we do have an app on the app store, particularly for drivers. So it's called Breeze Driver. Drivers go on there, digitally on board, put in some key information there, so we know that you're a real person, and we're able to vet you and verify all your details. But if you are a merchant or you're looking to onboard a new delivery partner, we are available at our website, breeze.co.za, B-R-E-A-Z-E, it's a unique spelling, .co.za. We're also on LinkedIn, Breeze Delivery, as well as Instagram and Facebook at Breeze Delivery as well.
There you have it, folks. Breeze Delivery, reach out to them. They are ready to sort out your logistical needs in the delivery space, no matter what kind of business you are running. And if you just want to check out their services, go to breeze.co.za. That's breeaze.co.za. Avi, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. We wish your business all of the best of luck, and we look forward to seeing you guys continue to do well. That's Avi Maja, who is a co-founder at Breeze Delivery, joining me for this week's SME.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've come to the end of our show, folks. We have also come to the end of our week. Parting thought, interesting parting thought. Going into next week, I might want to look at this and provide you with a bit of color. It looks like we could potentially not have a Nissan anymore going into 2025. The company is battling bankruptcy issues. They have lost significant profit margins. Their margins are down to about 0.5%, and they have cut more than, or they plan to cut more than 7,000 jobs. The business is really struggling. It needs an investor at the moment, and it is looking to potentially not survive into 2025. So we might look at that next week. But alongside that, we might have a solution to the problem if we can only get Elon Musk to have his compensation package approved. It's been declined or denied for the second time by a Delaware judge, citing initially, of course, it was denied because of the fact that the judge felt that the claim hadn't run through shareholders. Shareholders voted unanimously. 77% of them voted to have that compensation package approved. It was declined yet again. But those are stories for next week. For now, it's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hurst is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.